5 minutes past 10, and I'm Sizwe Mpofu-Walsh, standing in for you, CBS Makhaza, this week and the next. And we are going to move to the ever-popular Naked Scientist this hour. The Naked Scientist, Chris Smith, is back with us this week, and we've just opened our lines, taking your science questions on any subject. This is your opportunity to satisfy your curiosity, and just, if you've ever had a thought about something scientific and you want to know how it works or why it's there, why don't you give us a call? As you know very well, Dr. Smith is a medical doctor and scientist employed as a specialist registrar and clinical lecturer in virology at Cambridge University, the other place in the United Kingdom. And he is also the founder and driving force behind The Naked Scientist, which is an incredibly fascinating and popular BBC show and a hugely downloaded podcast series. So Dr. Smith, or even Chris, if I may, for the first time, welcome. Thanks so much again for joining us.
Morning. How are you?
Very, very well, thanks. Very well. And interesting story that you wanted to touch on today. We have lab-grown esophagus implanted in mice. So how on earth is this all working?
Yeah, this is amazing, actually. It's by researchers at University College London, Luca Urbani and his colleagues. And what they're describing in the journal Nature Communications this week is the first example of taking an esophagus, which is the food pipe that connects the back of your throat down to your stomach, and making a new one of it by growing new cells on an old esophagus. So let me make this clear. What they did was to take an esophagus from another animal, put it into a detergent solution, and this removes all of the cells that are there. And what that leaves behind is a scaffolding of the connective tissue. Now, you can think of this as a bit like the scaffolding that you put up when you build a building. You get poles, and then you put planks on the poles. Now, if you think of the cells as like the planks that you walk on, the scaffolding, if you remove the planks, is still there. So you could put new planks down. So what they've done is to take this so-called decellularized esophagus, which is just the connective tissue, and then they've added back to it new cells. They've added stem cells taken from humans, which are capable of making muscle. They also add some cells from mice, and they add some lining cells from rats, and they do that in order to make it easy to tell apart the different layers. And they grow in an organ bath, so you put this into nutrient solution, a new esophagus that works. Basically, wow. the way we think this works is that that scaffolding that's left behind has signals on it which can direct the cells where to go and what to turn into when the stem cells mature. And that guides them to become the right sort of cells in the right sort of configuration. And they were able to implant this esophageal tissue into the abdomens of experimental mice and show that it actually fully develops. So the next step, obviously, is going to be proving that not just this can develop and be viable, and the tissue is viable, and that it gets a vascular supply, blood coming and going, and also that nerve cells can grow in. Obviously, it's a big step now to demonstrate that you could put food down this, but that's going to be the next step, isn't it? And then ultimately, it'll be, can we do this in humans? Because there is a significant, small but significant proportion of infants are born with problems with their esophagus. And in some cases, they have no esophagus. In other cases, the esophagus is blocked. And sometimes these involve really major surgeries to put things right. So if we can grow someone a new esophagus using their own cells, there'll be no problem with the immune system rejecting the tissue, and hopefully we could make a functional and anatomically accurate version for them that would then grow using their own cells as they grow, which is going to be important as well. But this is an initial step, and it's a very exciting one.
Really, really interesting. I mean, I know that, you know, within a species, there's the ability sort of to graft, say, a tendon, and then it turns into a ligament, for example. But for this to happen in this dramatically different way is really, really fascinating for the future.
I think so. It's building on what we already know about how you can regrow tissues. And people have done an experiment a bit like this with lungs. About 10 years ago, scientists were able to grow new lungs by removing all of the cells from one pair of lungs and then recolonizing them with the right sorts of cells to grow new lungs. And they've also done this with hearts as well. This is at a very experimental stage. But something like an esophagus, probably a bit nearer the clinic, because it's simpler, it's got fewer cell types in it, and probably it's going to be an easier one to solve, but it's an important proof of concept, and it is a big clinical problem. So it offers us a number of important steps forward for a number of important reasons.
Absolutely, absolutely. And these sections of the esophagus were even capable of muscle contraction, is that right?
Yeah, because the muscle that's in there is a mixture of skeletal muscle, which is similar to what you find in the, this is in the normal esophagus, that you find in your arms and legs, and also smooth muscle that you find in blood vessels. And as you go down the esophagus, there's an important transition between that skeletal muscle and into smooth muscle. So what the researchers are trying to recreate is a similar sort of configuration. But the key thing about muscle is that it's electrically active. So once you put a signal into it, the muscle then passes the electrical signal on down all of the muscle in the organ, and you can get contraction, which would, if you were to put food in there, would propel the food along. And it appears that the muscle that they've built here is functional.
Absolutely incredible. Firstly, thank you for satisfying thank you for helping me to tick off my bucket list, being able to ask the naked scientist a science question. Chris, are you with us? And of course, now we're going to go. Yes, Chris is with us again.
Was that a question? Sorry, I didn't know if that was a question or not.
I was just saying thanks for allowing me to tick off my bucket list, being able to ask the naked scientist a question. But we've got so many calls.
Yes, you're most welcome.
We've got so many calls streaming in you wanting to just satisfy your curiosity on a whole range of scientific questions as ever. If you're also interested in this esophageal lining that's been grown in a lab, implanted into mice, feel free to call in. But we're going to take your calls now, and we're going to go straight to Nikki, who's in Santon and has a question for Chris. Nikki.
Hi, Chris. I wanted to know your thoughts on phages, and is there anywhere in the UK where they are making them and they're being successful?
That's phages, Nikki.
Hello, Nikki. Yes, so the question that's being discussed here is the bacteriophage. Phage is short for the word bacteriophage, and these are viruses that prey on bacteria. So in the same way that humans catch a cold caused by viruses, which are tiny parasites which invade our cells, hijack them, and turn them into virus factories, destroying the cell in the process, there are similar entities that attack bacterial cells. And before we had mainstream antibiotics, and up until, I think, the 40s, 50s, 60s, in some parts of the world, scientists were actively exploring the use of these entities as a form of antimicrobial treatment. And the reason they were doing that is these viruses, these bacteriophages, are very selective about the bacteria that they will attack. So they could be a really useful way. If you had an infection in your body, you could put them into your bloodstream, and this was done, and they will only bind onto bacterial cells and kill only one specific type of bacterium. So that sounds really promising. Now, along come antibiotics, though, and they're much easier to deal with. Phages are not that easy to identify the right ones, get the culture that you need, get them into the body, etc. Whereas antibiotic molecules, very easy to mass produce, very easy to administer. You can just pop a pill, swallow them, they work, and then everyone's a winner. So as a result, because it was easier to use antibiotics, the research into phages dried up and wasn't pursued with the same vigour that it had been. Now, some laboratories are still doing this, and there are some laboratories in the UK, and I've spoken to some of the researchers who are doing this. They're looking at fairly specific examples. There's one lab at the University of Leicester. Martha Clokey is the lady who's doing the work. She is exploring Clostridium difficile. This is one of the hospital superbugs you can get when you have the wrong sorts of antibiotics given to you when you're unwell, and you can get this inflammation in your intestine. She's looking at bacteriophages that might be able to deal with that. Other laboratories are looking at bacteriophages that could treat ear infections, not just in people, but also in animals, because ear infections and otitis externa, which is inflammation and infection in your ear canal, is a big problem in certain animals, like dogs. So researchers are looking for bacteriophage treatments for that too. And in some countries, they are actively pursuing this as a way of treating things like MRSA. But it's not mainstream at the moment because we still have antibiotics that are working. And as a result, people are fairly complacently, in some respects, just pursuing antibiotic research rather than going down the bacteriophage line.
Very interesting. Thanks so much for taking that question, Chris. We're with the naked scientist as ever. this Friday, and we are fielding your questions and satisfying your curiosity around scientific questions. We'll be back again with Chris straight after this break. About to hit 20 minutes past 10, and we are discussing all your questions about any scientific issue that comes to mind with Dr. Chris Smith, the naked scientist. And I'm going to go to Robert, who wants to follow up on the story of lab-grown esophageal tissue in mice. Robert?
How's it going?
Good.
You're good. Chris, I just want to ask you something. I was diagnosed with first stage of Barrett's esophagus a few years ago. And when I heard this thing on the radio now, I was actually quite surprised at it, because obviously for me it would help me in the future. What is the chances of them doing it, a transplant of the esophagus into a human, an adult human, and how long will it take for that to realize? I'll listen on the radio.
Thank you very much for the question. This is a very important topic, and it's very important to reassure you when you have a diagnosis of Barrett's esophagus about what may or may not be happening. Now, for the people who are not familiar with this, Barrett's esophagus, named after, I think, eponymously after the person who first described it, is a change in the cell type that you see lining one part of the esophagus, the food pipe in your gut. And it is thought to happen because the acid from the stomach irritates the lining of the esophagus and causes the cells to change their appearance to become better at defending themselves against acid. But in the course of undergoing that change, there is a small risk that those cells could begin to grow out of control and become cancerous. So some people with Barrett's esophagus are in what we call a pre-malignant state. That means that they have a higher chance of developing cancer later. Some people with it, though, will find that it just goes away. So usually when a person's detected with Barrett's esophagus, what doctors will do is keep a closer eye on them to pick up any changes early so that they can do something about it. So that's what Barrett's esophagus is. Now, if the worst came to the worst, and say a person had esophageal cancer, then the treatment for esophageal cancer is usually an esophagectomy. And what that means is that a surgeon will go in and they will remove at least a segment of the esophagus that's got the abnormal cells, the cancer cells, in it, and they would bring the ends together. Sometimes it's not possible to stretch the remaining tissue sufficiently, so you would have to move the stomach up a bit. And if you have to do that, then sometimes it can limit how much food a person can eat. It can spoil their quality of life. So one possibility of being able to regrow bits of tissue, like these researchers are doing, is that you might be able to regrow someone a segment of esophagus, and you could implant that. Now, whenever dictating or suggesting about how, not dictating, I don't know why I said that, whenever trying to predict was the word I was trying to use, whenever trying to make predictions about how things are going to play out in medicine, you have to be very cautious, because you never say never in medicine. Some things happen very quickly, but many things, because we absolutely must not get this wrong, because if we do, you could take a bad situation and make it a whole lot worse. Usually we're very cautious about making any kinds of predictions about this kind of thing. And so the answer that all people trot out is they say, oh, 5 years. That's their stock answer. Give it 5 years. But the reality is this. If you look at how long it takes to make just a new drug molecule, like a new antibiotic or a new blood pressure pill, It takes 10 years or more from it being in a test tube to it being in a needle that goes into a patient or a pill that a person can swallow. And it usually costs about $10 billion as well. So this is at very early stages, this work. So the translation is definitely, the will to translate it is definitely there, but the process is going to be very slow, because this is very early stage research and it's absolutely critical to get it right, and for the reasons that I've outlined of safety. So I wouldn't be expecting new esophagus tissue to be grown in a tube and put into a person in under the next 10 years, at least, I wouldn't think.
Okay, thanks so much. So many of your calls coming in. Let's go to Bukhosi, who wants to speak about the Hadron Collider.
Gentlemen, good morning.
Morning.
Mr. Mpofu, you seem to be a good stand-in for your third year.
Thanks so much.
I just want to find out what's the latest that's coming out of the Hadron Collider in Switzerland. I know they were chasing something, a phenomenon known as the God particle. Was that ever cracked, and what have you learned out of that? My second question, I'll put it for next week to give other people a chance.
Thanks so much, Ntate. Chris?
Right. Well, first of all, the LHC. What is the LHC? It's the Large Hadron Collider. Hadrons are protons. They're the particles that make up the nucleus in an atom, the positive charges, and they're accelerated to within a whisker of the speed of light in particles in streams in opposite directions. They smash into each other, and when they collide, the energy that's unleashed can reveal what those particles are themselves made of and can also enable us to probe new states of matter, new particles, and discover new dimensions, potentially, in physics. Now, the God particle that you're referring to is the particle that was discovered for the first time probably in 2012 and confirmed again since, and that was the Higgs boson, the Higgs particle, and named after Peter Higgs, who lives in Edinburgh, and got him the Nobel Prize. And the reason that the God particle is important is because when physicists drew up a table of everything we knew about the matter that makes up, or the material that makes up the universe, there was one thing they couldn't explain, which is why, when we have some atoms, why they have mass. In other words, if I've got a molecule of carbon dioxide, I can say, if I've got a 10 to the 23 atoms of that, 6 times 10 to the 23 atoms of that, it's going to weigh, C is 6 and O is 8, so that's O2, 18. I can add it up and I can say, I can work out exactly how many grams there should be of that. We didn't know why things had mass, and there was a gap in this jigsaw puzzle of the structure of the model of matter. And the experiments that were done at the LHC revealed the presence of this notional Higgs particle predicted by Peter Higgs, which would explain why things had mass by creating the so-called Higgs field. And it's the interaction of the material that things are made of with that Higgs field that pervades the universe that gives things mass. Now, because they've discovered that, it doesn't mean that the job of CERN is over. CERN has been running the LHC for 10 years now. It's just celebrated its 10th birthday, and it continues to do important science. Hmm. Scientists are trying to understand, for instance, why gravity is so weak. Is there an additional set of dimensions that particles can move in that we're not familiar, or we don't understand what those dimensions are, that we can't see them, we don't move in them? Can we reveal them by smashing particles together and measuring their mass, for example? Can we understand new physics from doing this? So the work is still very much continuing to try and understand what the universe is made of. So it's certainly not a job done yet.
Absolutely. And we're going to stick on the question of fields now as we go to Paul, who wants to ask a question about magnetism.
Yeah, hi, Chris. Hi, Cedric.
Hi.
I want to know why your common fridge magnet, speaker magnet, why does ferrum have to be present? Why can't I make brass magnetic? Why can't I make copper magnetic? Why does it have to be iron?
Okay.
Yeah, why is iron special? The reason is, Paul, for this, that when we have a magnet, what's going on magnetically is if you were to zoom in and look at the iron, you find structures called domains. We talk about this quantum property called spin. It's not really things spinning round, but it's helpful to think of it in terms of things orbiting in a certain direction. So if you imagine these domains, these are like mini magnets inside a magnet. If I take an unmagnetized piece of iron, these miniature domains, which have got a spin, the spins on all of the different domains all over the material are all pointing in random directions. So even though they're all making miniature magnetic fields, they're all cancelling each other out, so the piece of material is not magnetic. But if I put it into a magnetic field, for instance, if I make an electromagnet out of it, or I put it near another magnet, or I heat the metal up and then apply a magnetic field to it and then cool it down, it will lock all of those domains into sync so that all of the magnetic fields add up, and then you get a permanent magnet. Now, it's a property of iron, but also some other materials as well. There are a number of materials that can be magnetized. They're known as susceptible materials. It's not just iron, and it's to do with them having the right properties that enable them to have those magnetic domains. And other materials don't have that property, but just because of the configuration of their electrons and the way the actual physical particles work, and so they can't be magnetized in the same way.
Okay. Thanks so much. Many of your calls coming in. Going to try and get to as many of you as possible. We've got Steve in Mill Park.
Hi.
Chris, I'd like to know of what positives there are with regards to the right stroke CO machine, SCIO.
I didn't really catch the question very well. Can you just explain again for me?
Steve, could you explain again what you mean by the is it SIO machine?
SCIO. It works on energy waves.
I don't know what this is, Steve. You'll have to explain a bit more about it and what the context is, please.
No, it's an alternative to medicine, to natural medicine as such, and it works on the energy waves of the human. And they say that the energy waves are very similar, or not dissimilar, to your DNA. Everyone's energy waves are particular to that specific person. I just thought maybe you knew a little bit more about it.
No, I'm not terribly expert on alternative remedies and alternative medicine. I'm more of a traditional medicine man. This is not something I've come across, and to be honest, it sounds a bit iffy to me. If someone produces a clinical trial about these energies in humans and shows they're there, then I'm very happy to embrace this and advise patients to do it. But I've never seen any such thing, so for this at this moment, I'm not convinced.
Okay, thanks. Thanks so much, Chris. Thanks, Steve. We're going to go to Stuart, who has one question on the speed of light.
Hi there. Regarding the speed of light, I was just wondering if it is affected by the physical movement of objects. So, for instance, we know if, say, I'm standing on the back of a bucky and I'm driving 100 kilometers an hour, and I throw a ball forward and I throw a ball backwards, the ball's going to go at different speeds because of how fast I'm going. So is light that's traveling forward, going at, like, for instance, with the light off the bucky that's going forward, be going 100 kilometers an hour faster than light, and with the light going backwards off the bucky, basically going 100 kilometers slower than the speed of light?
Thanks, Stuart.
Yeah, this is a classic mind-boggler, this one. The answer is that the speed of light is always the speed of light. So if you imagine that you're standing on your bucky or whatever, and you throw a ball, yes, you're absolutely right. The speed of the ball that you measure will be the speed of the bucky that it was already going at plus the speed you throw the ball in either direction. So if the ball goes in the opposite direction to the bucky, then obviously it's going to be going a different. It's going to have speed taken off of it. Now, light does not do this, and this is the weird thing. If you were to shine a torch beam ahead of you, and you measure the speed of light going away from you, then you would measure the light travelling away at the speed of light, in either direction. So then you ask the question, well, what happens if I, standing by the roadside, watch you shining your light? What do I see? And the answer is that I measure the same thing. I measure the light travelling away from you at the speed of light. I don't see the light also adding its velocities up, even though you're moving away from me. And this is the really confusing thing, and that's why we think not of space as just space, but as space-time. Because in order to keep things working out, what has to change is that time has to bend and warp for us to make this work. And that's what relativity is based upon. That was Einstein's theory of special relativity.
Well, speaking of time warps, we've come to the end of our time, Chris. Thanks so much for fielding questions and satisfying the curiosity of our listeners once again this week. Wishing you all the best for the week ahead.